Welcome to the Belt and Railroad Podcast, where we cover the latest news, research, and analysis on China's growing presence in the developing world. I am your host, Eric Maestrino, coming to you today from a very pleasant Durham, North Carolina. Sadly, today, Juliet is out moving across the country, so she will not be joining us today. Remember, if you want to stay up to date on the latest news, research, and analysis on the Belt and Road Initiative, that you can follow our Twitter and Facebook pages at Belt and Road Pod. We love the discussions and that get to happen on our social media feed. So please follow and join in on the discussion. Frequent listeners to our show know one of our common themes is trying to really break down the state-centric narratives of China's internationalization and looking for more grounded approaches to the phenomenon. In recent years, there's been great research that not only understands the China side, but then the response that has been able to show the wonderful counterbalance showing the host country agency into the picture. Taking a step further, I came across some wonderful research that not only looks at the host country state agency, but also allows to see Chinese capital and how Chinese capital and expertise is utilized by host country central states as a way of either influencing peripheral geographic areas or also peripheral areas able to exercise some agency either with a central government or with Chinese actors alike. And that's why I'm so excited to be able to bring on the researcher for today's show Eliza Gambino, who has been studying these topics and more through the Lamu and Bagamoyo ports in Kenya and Tanzania. Today, we're going to be discussing your upcoming paper, Chinese Participation in Kenyan Transport Infrastructure, Reshaping Power Geometries. Eliza Gambino is a doctoral researcher on the African Governance and Space Project at the University of Edinburgh's Center of African Studies, where she is contributing research on Chinese engagement in East African infrastructure development and Africa's role in the Belt and Road Initiative. Yeah, welcome to the Belt and Road Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get into the details on the Lamu port, can you give a brief historical background on Lamu County and its history in Kenya?
Absolutely. Lamu County is located in the northern coastal region of Kenya at the border with Somalia. Similarly to many other regions in northern Kenya, Lamu has a long history of marginalization. And to understand what this means, it is important to look at the history of the region. So first of all, the maritime tradition of Lamu can be traced back to 1,000 after descendants, when Lamu was a trading settlement for goods between the Arabian Peninsula, East Africa, but also coastal empires in Asia. Later, from the 1200s, Lamu was an important link between landlocked regions in the African continent and Asia. And in the 16th century, because of gold trade from Zimbabwe, this region was an important caravan stop route and also a trade hub. Later, it was under the influence of the Sultan of Zanzibar, and it was then claimed under the German colonial rule in 1885, but quickly, together with the rest of Kenya, it fell under British colonial rule. During the colonial rule, Kenya was organized in administrative regions, but this structure was focused on retaining centralized power and deploying resources in specific areas of the territory that were occupied by white settlers or that were related to their economic activities. And Lamu was not a prominent location at this time due to the development of Mombasa Port and also the construction of the colonial railway that was linking Mombasa to Nairobi. At the beginning of the 1960s, during the independence negotiation, minority groups within Kenya advocated for a constitutional system that recognized different regions. And at this point in time, there was a concern by minority groups that the clientelist structure of power that had characterized the colonial era already would then be replicated through power being concentrated in the hands of the most populous ethnic groups. There were some initial calls to actualize devolution, but the first government of Jomo Kenyatta abolished regional administrations, leaving certain areas unable to access funds or other types of resources. And this furthered the unequal development of Kenya. The call for devolution reemerged and intensified greatly during the 1980s and 1990s. And during this period, there were also several controversies that emerged between the residents of Lamu County, what is now Lamu County, and the government ministries in Nairobi. One example, also related to infrastructure, which is what I discuss mainly in my research, is an example of the landing jetty that leads from Manda Island, where the airport is, to Lamu Town, which is on an island just opposite Manda. This jetty collapsed several times, and in 1986, when it collapsed for the first time, a contractor was not assigned to this contract, and four years later, the residents resorted to a harambe, which is a crowdfunding self-help practice, which is very common in the country, to raise money to repair the jetty, which was really important for the tourism industry in the area. But I would say that the turning point for the devolution cause was the post-election violence in 2007-2008, and the 2010 constitutional reform mandated the formation of 47 counties, which all have devolved powers. The counties' administrations were first elected in 2013, and this was an initiative aimed to promoting the equal distribution of resources and power to reduce the inequalities that had characterized the relations between the peripheries and the center in the past. And the project of Lamu, but also the broader connectivity initiative it is part of, the Lamu Port South Sudan Transport Corridor, LAPSSET, should be seen in this context because they represent new avenues for the state to redeploy itself through the promotion of development initiatives in areas that now are seen as new frontiers, but that earlier were seen as being in the back burner.
And I think it's so important for, in the grander context of all, if you want to call them Belt and Road projects or all infrastructure projects that have Chinese actors or stakeholders in it, that so many of them exist in areas that have contentious histories with infrastructure itself. And so it's great to be able to hear at least a little bit of context for what we're going to talk about today. And we were talking about the Lamu port. And so, what are the origins specifically for the Lamu port, and who are the current players that are involved in the project now?
So the origins of the current project for Lamu can be traced to just a few years after independence. Already in the early 1970s, there had been a scoping study done by a French consultant to find the best location for Kenya's second port. These reports suggested that Lamu would be a good location for a second port, but that due to the lack of connectivity infrastructure in the area, these should be considered as a long-term project. At the time, funds were directed to the expansion of Mombasa port instead, but Lamu port project resurfaced back in 2004, when the government started drafting the Integrated National Transport Policy, which is an initiative designed to integrate development goals and infrastructure needs. So the Kenyan government at this time focused on infrastructure as a tool for integrating in the national economy some areas that were in the peripheries. And it was revived as part of a corridor project already, the railroad, oil pipeline, oil refinery, Lamu port and airport, briefly called ROLA project, that was financed by NEPED. But the project was abandoned due to increasing criticism to the lack of due process for financing scoping studies. And then in 2011, LAPSSET corridor was initiated, and Lamu port was reintroduced as part of this broader initiative.
Can you go a little bit as to what the LAPSSET corridor is for maybe some listeners who don't know?
Absolutely. LAPSSET corridor is a connectivity initiative that includes seven components: a railway, a highway, pipelines, an oil refinery, Lamu port, airports, and also some resort cities, along a route that is expected to stretch from Lamu port to South Sudan and Ethiopia, or the other way around. And this is a flagship project of the National Developmental Agendas of Kenya, Kenya Vision 2030. And similarly, it is grounded in the same rhetoric of opening up remote areas of the country, integrate them into the national economy, and it echoes the state's understanding of Lapset Corridor, but also of other development corridors in the country. The national government is extending its reach and power over the peripheries in what is called the practice of territorialization. And it is really not surprising that then the implementation authorities and the decision-making processes for the implementation of Lapset Corridor are centralized amongst national-level state actors, so to have this opportunity to streamline and better implement and have a better hold over the decision-making processes.
So Lapset was a central Kenyan or East African government's initiative. And how and when did Chinese stakeholders get involved in Lapset, if they did at all, and including in the Lamu port?
So the involvement in Lamu port came when there was a tender published by the implementing authority, Lapset Corridor Development Authority. And this tender was won by a Chinese state-owned enterprise in 2013. But there are several more actors involved. So the contractor right now, it's the Chinese state-owned enterprise, China Communication Construction Company, through its subsidiary, China Road Bridge Corporation. But there are several other actors, and I think it's really important here to make a point about Chinese involvement, and particularly the involvement of Chinese state and enterprises. Often the involvement, both through investment, but also through participation as engineering, procurement, construction, it's associated with the direct involvement of Chinese state actors. And in my work, particularly in my doctoral dissertation, I try to unpack China and investigate the relationship between state-owned enterprises and the state. So I try not to brush them off as just another branch of the Chinese state, but to look at how the relationship with the Chinese state has evolved in the 40 years of economic reforms that have taken place in China. And I think that Lamu Port and the involvement of Chinese actors in Lapset more broadly offers a really good insight into this relationship, because throughout the 40 years of reform, which have included market liberalization reforms, but also state and enterprises reform in terms of managerial reforms, but also in terms of their role in the internationalization and in supporting the Chinese, the growth of the Chinese economy, has been really major. And I think it's really important to see how Chinese state-owned enterprises operating overseas have gained relative operational autonomy with regards to their operation overseas. So through the establishment of overseas headquarters, they have the possibility to participate in EPC tenders, such as the one for the first phase of Lamu Port, independently and without requiring the direct involvement of Chinese state actors. However, with more Chinese interest also comes to mind the geopolitical significance of the region and also the geopolitical importance of maritime infrastructure. So for Lapset, this pivotal moment came in 2019 when Lapset Corridor was nominated a project catalyzing connectivity during the Second Belt and Road Initiative Forum. In the same year, ChemChina UK, a subsidiary of the state-owned enterprise China National Chemical Corporation, won the bid to purchase the first export of crude oil from Turkana that are expected to be transported to Lamu through the planned pipeline part of Lapset. And in the same year, China Merchants Port, which is a subsidiary of another state and enterprise, China Merchants Group, submitted an investment proposal to the Kenyan government in which they expressed their interest to negotiate a public-private partnership to cover the remaining cost of phase one, build other three berths in Lamu Port, carry out operations, and at the same time develop a city and an industrial park, which is a type of special economic zone.
So Lapset is now, since the 2019 Belt and Road Forum, is now the included in Belt and Road. What's the correct wording here?
It's Project Catalyzing Connectivity of the Belt and Road Initiative.
Huh. Yeah, that's so fascinating how really what can be placed under the Belt and Road Initiative seems to really go, you know, both ways, where many of the projects that happen under CMEC, which is the China-Myanmar Economic Corridor I'm more familiar with, you know, lots of those main projects are very much China-driven. It's very much in their own backyard. But with LAPSET, I mean, you had these Chinese state-owned enterprises who were working on their own accord, or somewhat with a relative amount of autonomy, finding their own projects for more maybe economic reasons, building out these EPC contracts. And the Kenyan government then, or the East African regional governments, bring it up to China to become a part of the Belt and Road. Just a comment more than a question.
I also find it really interesting because it is very common now that projects that were initiated and that even began construction before the Belt and Road Initiative, when it was announced in 2013, or after the African continent became a central part of the Belt and Road Initiative, can still be then incorporated under this Belt and Road Initiative umbrella.
Yeah, very much so. What's the current state of the LAMU port? Like, is it being built right now? Is it operational? Where does this LAMU port stand right now?
Right now, one of the berths has been completed and the other two are under construction. But for the upcoming phases, the Kenyan government is looking for investors that are willing to participate through public-private partnerships to the development of other berths up to a total of 23.
Okay. Huh. And so as in many cases with Belt and Road projects across the world, you know, land politics has played a major role in LAMU ports development. What are and have been the major land issues within LAMU ports development?
The major land issues for LAMU port have mainly revolved around land compensation, but also land allocation. Before the construction started, the central government had begun to acquire land for the port and also the special economic zone. But there were issues of loss of livelihood and compensation for this livelihood, and at the same time, some instances of land grabbing. But the controversies that was brought to light by the necessity to allocate land for the special economic zone came after the proposal of China Merchants Port to build the special economic zone. And it emerged that the county government and the national government had been allocating different lands for the construction of the Kenya Vision 2030 Special Economic Zone. And this relates to what I was discussing earlier in terms of national county government relations and how these historical patterns can be reproduced or definitely echo in today's relationship.
So you're saying that the land that came up from China Merchants Group, the expansion to a special economic zone and urban city that comes next to the LAMU port, that the county government and the national government had set aside different land to be used for it?
No, beforehand.
Oh.
So beforehand, they were setting up land.
Yes.
But they were allocating different lands for the special economic zone that was planned under the Kenya Vision 2030. But then when China Merchants Port brought the proposal to the national government, it became apparent that they had been allocating two different lands for the same purpose. And of course, the proposal of China Merchants Port is still under review by the central government, by the national government. But within the county government, there had been a process whereby they had been allocating land that belongs to and is under the direct control of the county government after the devolution process. And they had been allocating this land for the future special economic zone. But at the same time, the national authority, LAPSET Corridor Development Authority, had already begun acquiring land for the special economic zone together with the land for the port construction. The process is now of land acquisition is yet to be concluded, but they had acquired most of the land already by March last year. And the fact that the land designated for the construction of the special economic zone is not the same between the national government authority of LAPSET Corridor and the LAMU County speaks to a broader narrative around the lack of involvement of county government into the decision-making processes for development initiatives that are started and promulgated and also implemented from the center, from the national government in Nairobi.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So you have China Merchants Group, you have much more Chinese involvement or Chinese stakeholder involvement happening in Lapset and around the Lamu port. How has, if it has, Chinese capital changed power dynamics in Kenya's central government and its relation to Lamu County?
The Chinese involvement in Kenya has a long history, but there is definitely some learning process that has been going on both sides, between Chinese companies, but also on the Kenyan aspect. The internationalization of Chinese companies has been going on until the 80s, especially for state-owned enterprises. China Road Bridge Corporation, the SOE currently building Lamu Port, had established headquarters in Nairobi already in 1984. So they have over 35 years of experience of operations in Kenya. And they definitely underwent a learning process with regards to the Kenyan political and business scene alike. But the relationship between China and Kenya as countries has not always been as smooth as it has been in the past 35 years. During the initial stages of independence, particularly up until 1967, there were very big tensions between Kenyatta's government and the Maoist regime in China. There were origins because of the in-party hostility within Kenya on the stance that the Kenyan government should take in with regards to China. So in the early independence period, Kenyatta's faction of the party was determined to develop the country's cooperation with the US and the European Union, European nations. While on the other side, Jaramogi Odinga, who had led a delegation to Beijing soon after independence, wanted to have closer ties with China, particularly in light of all the support that China had demonstrated for independence movement across the African continent. But Kenyatta's faction had the upper hand, and high-profile diplomatic representation was halted in 1967. There were 11 years where the diplomatic relations were lowered at a charge d'affaires, and China-Kenya relations only improved after Mao's exit from the government in 1976, and at the same time that of Kenyatta 2 years later. So in 1978, when Moi was elected, a Kenyan ambassador was sent to China for the first time in 11 years. And Moi himself then visited the country in 1980. And it's here that the renewed relations between these two countries flourished and led to increasing cooperation, which in turn was very beneficial to China Road Bridge Corporation, that could in 1984 begin their internationalization journey in Kenya. And looking at Chinese involvement in Lamu County, there's definitely examples that speak to an evolution of power relations between the county and the national government, but also to the learning process that CRBC, China Road Bridge Corporation, has undergone in the 35 years of experiences, and recently the completion of the Nairobi Mombasa Standard Gauge Railway, which is probably the biggest project that CRBC, definitely the biggest project that CRBC has carried out in Kenya. And the emergence of new actors and new connections is a central point in the role of the Chinese companies, but also in the respective roles of the county and the national government. There are several examples of Lamu County civil society opposition to certain development projects that were promulgated by the center and at the same time approved by the national government. One example is a coal plant that was supposed to be a joint venture between a Chinese and a Kenyan company and was expected to be built in Lamu County. But the decision to approve the design of these plans prompted a very strong reaction from civil societies in Lamu, which eventually brought this plan to court and managed to get the plant suspended till indefinite time. And in the case of Lamu Port, the historical marginalization can be reproduced to patterns of exclusion from the decision-making processes. But at the same time, the county government has established a direct line with the Chinese company constructing this project. The county government has a very strong reach on its territory. It can play a very important role by advancing their interests. But at the same time, this often leaves them negotiating and balancing the expectations of their constituents and at the same time, those of the national government.
Yeah, and Vin, in particular in your article, you go on to talk about this phenomenon of county government agency and their interactions with Chinese state-owned enterprises, particularly in the localization of the labor force and then local content agreements. What were the parameters for local content contracted by the Kenyan government, and how did this play out on the ground in Lamu County?
So the fulfillment of local content requirements was that 75% local content for Lamu Port should be Kenyan. So what this means is that either labor force, materials, subcontracting, even cement, if we talk about materials, should be sourced within Kenya. And this is, however, specific to Lamu Port project. So for Lamu Port project, it was agreed at 75%. But in other projects also constructed by CRBC, such as the Nairobi-Mombasa SGR, that was at 40% and it was added post signing the contract. So I think this speaks to a broader discourse around labor relations and also employment of local laborers in Chinese companies. But at the same time, the local content requirements are very relevant to the national government in terms of percentages. So in the case of Lamu Port, there has been a controversy that arose around the employment of local labor. So the 75% is currently being fulfilled, because over 1,000 employees on the construction site are Kenyans and just about 200 are Chinese. This was not the case at the beginning of construction, where most of the workers were Chinese. But over time, there was an overcompensation, and right now it's over 75%. The same company, CRBC, had faced similar issues in terms of fulfillment of local content requirements for the construction of SGR. Although there was a 40% added to the contract throughout the construction, there had been several protests along the SGR route that had led protesters to enter the construction site, sometimes attacking Chinese workers, and were demanding that their rights were respected and they were brought to the forefront of the agenda of the deciding parties. So the idea was that locals were being hired, but they weren't local to the specific part of construction that was taking place. Hmm. So for example, these workers would be moved together with the construction, with the Chinese workers, with the machineries and so on, from one county to the other, and they would follow the path of construction. This is a very common practice that allows this Chinese company to avoid having to train new workers while at the same time respecting Kenyan contractual obligations and saving money, because they do not have to retrain workers. But this results in a difficulty of distributing labor opportunities across all the counties that the SGR was crossing. And even though Lamu is only in one county, similar concerns presented and were particularly concerns that Lamu indigenous populations had. And this comes to the idea that it comes from the fact that local and the definition of who is a local is very multifaceted and is not as straightforward as it might seem from when it's on paper in a contract. Of course, to a Chinese contractor, any Kenyan is a local worker. But even within the construction site, Chinese engineers are well aware of the fact that most workers are not from Lamu Archipelago, and they're not Swahili populations, but they are either migrant workers from upcountry or non-Swahili people from Lamu County. And this also becomes more multifaceted when one asks, well, who is a local? To Lamu County officials or to residents of the Lamu Archipelago. And Lamu Archipelago residents make a very clear distinction between the archipelago, mainly inhabited by Swahili people, and the rest of the county. While the county would say that anyone who has the right to vote in Lamu County, so it's part of the constituency, would be a local. So this shows how multifaceted one single requirement can be and how indigenous groups of Lamu Archipelago then mobilize to advocate for further participation in the development of Lapset Corridor components so that they would also reap economic benefits to, and you know, at the same time protect the biodiversity of their environment and also the marine environment, which is fundamental to their livelihoods.
How are the local complaints heard, or how do they get their voices or to have any form of influence, either to the local government or to the Chinese state-owned enterprises?
Yeah, so because these complaints were raised on several platforms, so either directly to the county government or to community assemblies, and they all had something in common, which was a feeling of marginalization in the selection process altogether. To mitigate this controversy, then CRBC and the county government deployed a strategy that was already in place in the construction of the SGR. And this, again, speaks to the learning process that Chinese companies undergo when they're operating overseas. So this direct line of communication means that the contractor communicates job openings to relevant county, to the county government, which then would recommend workers to the company. So this means that Lamu County government would have an initial role in selecting possible candidates for job openings on the construction site. And this is not, however, inserted in the EPC contract or follows any contractual obligation. But it does allow a new relation to emerge between the county government and the Chinese contractor directly. And this, even though Swahili populations of Lamu County might continue to feel marginalized as they still do not benefit from the opportunities created by infrastructure development, they will have the possibility through the county government of having direct relations with CRBC, should this be necessary and possible if there are job openings.
Wow. Well, this is just amazing research. I know that this is the paper, Chinese Participation in Kenyan Transport Infrastructure Reshaping Power Geometries, is a forthcoming paper. Do you have any idea when or where it will be published?
So it will be published in a special issue of Critique Internationale, which is a French journal. So the special issue is titled Le Politique d'Emergence. And due to the current coronavirus situation, we are not entirely sure of when it will be out, but it will most likely be towards the end of this year or early next year.
Well, when it comes out, I highly, highly recommend all of you read it and read all of her, Eliza's other writing. She has a great article on the Asia Dialogues website from February called Job Insecurity, Labor Contestation, and Everyday Resistance at the Chinese-Built Lamu Port Site in Kenya. I highly recommend you check it out. I'll put it in the show notes. Eliza, will you stick around for recommendations?
Thanks. Of course, I'd love to.
You've been listening to the Belt and Road podcast. Remember, if you want to stay up to date on the latest news, research, and analysis on the Belt and Road Initiative, follow us at Belt and Road Pod. So what would you like to recommend our listeners today?
Well, of course, in terms of Chinese construction sites, I highly recommend Tales of Hope, Tastes of Bitterness, Chinese Road Builders in Ethiopia by Miriam Dressen.
Yes, yes.
Brilliant, a brilliant book. And more on the fun side, I recommend Invisible China by Colin Leggerton and Jacob Rawson, which is a lovely ethnographic account of a journey through borderlands in China.
Wonderful. Those are two great recommendations. The first one, I just started. I got up to the first chapter, and I love it thus far. So
It's so good. Yeah, I think I read it 3 times already, because, of course, it's extremely relevant to the work I did in the construction site. I mean, obviously, she did a year ethnography, while I only did a little. Compared to that, it seems like nothing, but definitely there's so many similarities. It's a brilliant book.
Yes. So triple recommend that book. And for me, there was a short article in The Diplomat, Putting a Dollar Amount of China's Loans to the Developing World by Huang Yufan and Deborah Brodigam. It talks about the new World Bank data that came out, that finally the World Bank was able to published in the least developed countries, at least the dollar amount of debt from the Chinese policy banks that these countries hold. And the Diplomat article has the insight you need to be able to gain from what new data is out there. And second is a little bit more esoteric, but living in a mid-tier American city. This is, I guess, very specifically to an American, but I've spent many of my years in my life on major coastal cities in California and New York City, and I love those places, and you know, I like to live there, but they are so crazy expensive. And my wife and I was just bought a house in our little city of Durham, North Carolina, and I've been able to live and travel throughout America and all these wonderful mid-tier cities. You can get really good, wonderful communities with arts and culture at a price that you can actually afford and live in. So move out to the center, and especially one in a swing state. So come on down to North Carolina and join me out here. But Eliza, thank you again for joining us on the Belt and Road podcast.
Thank you so much, Eric. It's been so much fun.